Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of the Fresh Sounds podcast. My name is Alex Eddington, and I'll be your host for the next 8 or 9 episodes at least. I am a composer and music educator based in Toronto, Canada. So the point of this podcast is that I wanted to talk to other composers across this country who, like I do, enjoy working with young and amateur musicians. Specifically writing for them or writing with them in a collaborative kind of way. And so I've put together a roster of really interesting people living in Canada, composing in Canada, who are either specializing in or trying out this idea of writing music for or with non-professional musicians. So the genesis of this podcast is with the Alliance for Canadian New Music Projects, otherwise known as the ACNMP, and I'll tell you more about them later. But they're an organization, a nonprofit organization, who act as a bridge in many different ways between composers and music students here in Canada. But already this has become a kind of a bigger project than that. The more composers I've talked to, I've had interviews with 3 so far, the more it seems to be becoming a kind of a conversational exploration of what music is and why we learn it and why people become composers and how we can encourage young people to be composers. So this isn't just about being a composer and working with students or amateur choirs. It's also something a little bit deeper and more less defined than that. So let's jump right into our first interview. I sat down virtually and had a great conversation with Laura Hawley, who is a Canadian composer, conductor, pianist, and educator known for her compelling approach to musical leadership and artistic programming, community engagement, distinctive compositional style, and advocacy for Canadian choral art. Yes, I'm reading Laura's bio out loud. I'm also going to be posting these things as well as many links in the show notes. So Laura's music, which is often influenced by creative community connections and exchanges, has been described in The Whole Note magazine as conjuring the forces of nature and its effect on the human spirit. And we certainly touched on many of these things in our conversation. So Laura's works have been commissioned, performed, and recorded by many fine choirs, including Canadian Chamber Choir, Pro Choro Canada, Electra Women's Choir, Vancouver Youth Choir, Cantiamo Choirs, and Toronto Children's Chorus. Her works are published by Oxford University Press, Rhythmic Trident Music Publishing, Cypress Choral Music, Silent Dawn Music Publishing, and on her website, laurahawley.ca. So Laura is also a conductor and educator and directs various choirs. She's currently in Edmonton, and she's the artistic director of the Decamera Singers, conductor of Chandratala, and a pianist and singer with the Canadian Chamber Choir. So without further ado, let's talk to Laura Hawley. So I guess we should talk about music. What do you think?
Sure.
So yeah, I'm a longtime podcast listener. I am a longtime lover of talking to people about stuff. So it's strange that here I am at my midlife crisis, finally starting my own podcast. Certainly I'm going to put an intro on this, but this is called Fresh Sounds. This is for the ACNMP, the Alliance for Canadian New Music Projects. And I'm sitting here today with Laura Hawley. I'm talking to you, but you are in Edmonton, is that right?
That's right.
Wow. You know, I lived in Edmonton for a while.
Oh, yeah?
Did I tell you that?
No, I didn't know that.
I lived in Edmonton for 3 winters. Back in the mid-2000s.
How did that go for you?
Well, the winters were tough, but until I picked up snowshoeing. Oh. And then that was a nice way to enjoy the trails in the winter. I just love the valley system in Edmonton.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. It's interesting because so many people say, like when I moved out here a couple years ago, people warned me and said, oh, you're going to have such a hard time with the winters. And it's like there's a complex about Edmonton winters, and Edmontonians also have this complex, but I'll tell you, I find them way easier than winters in Ottawa. The humidity in Ottawa makes it so hard, and here it's, you know, it's minus 20, but it's also like just minus 20. You don't have that humidity making it feel like minus 40 instead. We get the polar vortex. We're just coming out of that. It's been 2 weeks of deadly cold, but now it's sunny. It's like a balmy minus 12, and it's lovely. You can go outside and play, and it's all right.
That's really decent. Have you had those weeks of minus 40? Is that what you're talking about
Yeah,
last
we're just
week?
coming out of that.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Well, I was told that happens every winter, that there's
It
like that
does.
block of it, and it's brutal. How many years have you lived in Edmonton now?
This would be my third winter. I moved here in the summer of 2018.
Okay, so you've already lasted longer than I did when I was out there. I loved Edmonton. I went there pretty spontaneously for my master's degree at U of A. And that's actually the city that got me choral singing in a serious way, because there's just so many great choirs.
Yeah, the choral scene out here is great.
What's your favorite thing about Edmonton?
It this is going to be funny. I mean, aside from the choral scene, which is super strong and amazing and collaborative and awesome, like I just love the choir scene out here. But aside from that, I'm going to say the weather, in spite of everybody's warnings, because it's dry. Summers are gorgeous. You've got these long, long days where the sun's still shining. It's like
Oh
9:30
my
p.m. And
gosh, it's
yeah,
amazing.
it's pretty awesome.
I fell in love with the summers. I remember people would be out rollerblading at 10:30 p.m. People would be mowing their lawns that
Yeah.
late at night. Like, it feels like the day doesn't end.
Yeah, you can be out on your porch reading at, late into the night and early coffee on the on I apparently I love the porch. Everything is on the porch. Or like bicycle rides in the valley. Like I use my bike so
Oh,
much and I've
amazing.
been cross-country skiing.
Lovely. Well, I mean, I live right next to Lake Ontario in Toronto, and I pretty much always have. And when I was in Edmonton, I really missed being able to look out across a body of water that goes to the horizon. But you know what turned the corner for me was realizing that rivers are just as big, but they're long. And so that, and just like standing and staring at the volume of water going by. And I love that spring breakup time as well, when the ice is flowing down the river. You know, because it's
Yeah.
come such a long way to get there.
I really relate to that. I grew up in Port Elgin, which you're probably familiar with if you're in Toronto. It's about 3 hours north on Lake Huron.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think when you grow up near big water, it's sort of part of you. But we got a house a couple years ago, and I discovered this summer that you can walk along the river for forever on trails close by. And this summer, the water went down at one point toward the end of the summer, where I could actually leave the path and walk down and walk right next to the water.
Amazing.
I ended up having to sort of do a little bit of like creative small cliff scaling to get back up on the path when I ended that journey, but it was so great to just be next to the flowing water.
It's magic. And when you're down in that river valley, you don't feel like you're in the city a lot of the time. And I've heard about bears walking through there, you know, like animals use it as a green belt, which is just, we don't have anything like that. We had a deer in our backyard once in Toronto that really was lost and very upset. But I do not live next to a large forest. Somehow it got here. But yeah, I really do miss the nature of Alberta as well. Yeah, so let's use this to segue more into talking about music. So you're involved with choirs out there. What was the reason you moved to Edmonton?
Partially for the choir scene, partially to start a new chapter in life. When I moved out here, I had a couple of interesting opportunities lined up. And the other interesting part about that is once I actually arrived, all of those fell through. So I was sort of like, oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
So here I was, and that all worked out. That first year was very busy. I was still working with the choir, the women's choir in Ottawa that I founded, Hypatia's Voice. So I was flying back and
Okay.
forth. And then over the course of that first year, I was just meeting a lot of people in Edmonton, filling in for conductors, filling in for pianists, doing different things here and there, working on commissions. And then by the next year, I had been appointed the new artistic director of Decamera, which was amazing, amazing. I was so excited about that. And also had a new upper voices ensemble formed in the Kokopelli Choirs organization, Chandratala,
Right.
which I conduct. So it all worked out.
Let's just get right into it. I have some sort of probing questions to kind of get a sense of, you know, who you are as a musician and where you're at and where you come from. And then we can segue into talking about specifically the work that you've done with choirs. And especially, I'm really interested on this podcast in talking with composers about their work with young people and with those kind of non-auditioned choirs or people who are amateurs in the truest, fullest, most beautiful sense.
Yeah.
But let's get to that once we have a sense of kind of who you are. So I think the way to start is to ask you the big question. But can you answer in a concise way? How would you describe the music you compose, and like in a few words or a couple sentences, and then we can kind of go from there?
Oh man, concisely. I think this is such a hard question because I don't really stick to a specific style or genre or compositional technique. I've got things that sort of sound like, you know, an Anglican church anthem, and it's, you can hear in there influences of Harris and Howells and Macmillan. And I've got another piece that sounds like, you know, a raging tango. And then I've got another thing that sounds like electropop. And it's, at the same time, I've been told by a few people that they can recognize a piece of mine when they hear it before they know that I wrote it. So I'm really curious about why that is. And I'm also really delighted about that because I think that probably means I'm doing something unique, which is really important to me.
You have a style. Do you think that's a good thing in your mind, that you have a recognizable signature or a style to the music you write?
Yeah, I think so, because if someone's recognizing my music and it's standing out from something else, then I think it means that I'm contributing something that's different, which is really valuable to me. I think one of my pet peeves about myself is how easily I get aggravated by repetition and cliche. Not to say that I don't use those things that might be considered cliche in some of my writing, but I'm really content with the idea that there's something about what I'm doing that's different. I guess if I were trying to place my music kind of in a spectrum of modern composition, I'd probably place it on the more accessible side, both for the performer and for the listener. I've almost never written something that was written, well, I don't even think it's possible to write something in isolation. But I've almost always had an ensemble in mind that I'm writing for, whether it's a commission or a particular performance or something, you know, maybe I've heard an ensemble and I have their sound in my mind and that's what's driving me to write something with that sound. So, you know, in terms of the spectrum of like easy listening, I mean, I wouldn't put myself there, but I wouldn't put myself on the super experimental out there side of things. It's probably somewhere in the range of accessibility in terms of like what I hope it's doing is it's engaging the curiosity of the listener and the performer and maybe hopefully stretching them a little bit, but that they can kind of, there's an inroad to relatability there.
Absolutely. Relatability for audiences, but also for the performers themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I've noticed as I get more into writing choral music that I'm more at the experimental end of the spectrum by default, just because of the, you know, the way I studied composition and just the kind of person I am. It's funny you're talking about your signature style. I feel like everything I write is completely different, and there are sometimes
some surprising.
I feel
like that too. Yeah, I feel that way about my own music, but it turns out, nope, it all sounds the same.
So maybe people are picking up things in mind. I totally relate to what you're saying also about writing for performers. It could be that I've spent more time writing for professionals, you know, professional instrumentalists more. So when it comes to choirs, I've had to really notice that choral music tends to be, as you say, further along that spectrum toward accessibility. And I think there's a practical reason for that.
Yeah, I agree. And when I look at the things that I've written, like, I think you're right. Like when I've written for professionals, I do take things in a different direction for sure, because I can. And when I'm just working in my own compositional practice, I notice that I do steer towards, I would say, a broader spectrum of rhythmic and formal and harmonic complexity, even with, you know, extended techniques and that kind of thing, looking for new sounds. But the thing with writing for choirs is most choirs are made up of amateur musicians, but amateur musicians that usually have strong opinions of what they like. They have a lot of musical knowledge and a lot of musical experience and just like this whole wealth of sounds that they've been steeped in their whole lives. So, you know, I think I'm kind of aware of positioning myself somewhere in there, so that I fit in the in a context that makes sense for all of the musicians that are involved. So, yeah, it's, I guess it really is about who you're writing for.
Absolutely. And later we can talk about who you're writing with as well and whether that comes into play. So what would you say are your biggest inspirations as a composer? Like, is there something from outside the music that inspires it? Is it the text? Are there other things coming in there?
I think, you know, each thing has a different main driver. Probably the primary thing is going to be the performers. Who's performing it? What's the level that they're at? What's the context of the performance? Where does this piece fit in the program? What are they interested in? What do they like? What will challenge them? We're going to talk more later about young performers, but when I'm working with developing musicians, I'm usually thinking about where they might be in their own development and what they might learn from the particular piece, either musically or emotionally, or, you know, maybe it's in the context of a curriculum where they're exploring something.
Right.
But I often work with text because most of my writing is for choir. So it's also going to be heavily reliant on the text. When I have a poem that I'm setting, I spend a lot of time thinking about it, and very often, the more the poem resonates with me personally, I don't want to say the longer it takes me to come up with something, but I know I've had some texts recently that have felt so important to me. It took me a long time to figure out which direction I wanted to go with it to say what I felt I wanted to say in the music.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that text piece is really important. What the message is, what's the backstory, what does it mean to me, what does it mean to the performers, all that stuff.
When you're looking at a text, do you are you looking at the imagery, or is it the sounds of it, or are there different dimensions of it you're looking at?
I like to try different approaches for different texts. One of my most popular pieces is Sonnet 43. Which is a Shakespeare text. And what I wanted to do with that one, for example, was capture kind of a modern sensibility in the music, because it's hundreds of years old, but the sentiment of it is so relatable right now. It could be something that was written yesterday. So I wanted to take that into a style that felt really contemporary. I wrote another piece recently called Droplets. And what I did with that is I had a recording of the poet, Jenny Cousin, reading the poem. She's my favorite Canadian poet. Like, everything she writes feels so relatable to me.
Jenny Cousin. Okay. Yeah.
And so what I did as a starting point, I didn't really know where this would lead, but I just listened to her recording and I transcribed the rhythm of her reading. And that ended up informing a lot of the rhythm of the piece, which actually kind of, I took a dance direction. It's got kind of a Latin dance feel in it, because the poem's all about these droplets. It's from a series of poems called A Corona Sequence. And this poem talks about, you know, it opens, when you pass, dip your head. This is the adab of breath. It's kind of the protocol around just breathing currently in public. And as the poem progresses, it talks about how we're all one creature. So that idea that all liquid has been kind of circulated through generations and generations, we could be, you know, drinking the same water that Napoleon drank. I don't know. So, you know, that idea in that one kind of came out in this dancey feel, because we're all doing this weird dance around each other to try to not breathe on one another. And then it progressed into a four-part counterpoint texture, capturing that idea that we're all one creature, like all of these different things are happening simultaneously. So sometimes it's an emotional intent idea. Sometimes it's like, it's really the backstory of the text that ends up informing the musical direction that I want to take. But I like to play with different approaches all the time.
Right. Well, it sounds to me like you're taking this kind of piece by piece, text by text, and choir by choir in terms of how you approach, because you want to meet the words and the singers and the music where they're at anyway. Does that sound?
I think that's really accurate. And, you know, sometimes it's also super personal. Last year I wrote a piece for Vancouver Youth Choir and the text was taken from the novel Brave New World. And I read that novel at the same time as reading the book Sapiens by Yuval Harari. It's probably a lot of your listeners will have read that book, but reading them at the same time was so interesting because it felt like I was reading the same book. So this piece, this piece was a setting of one of the hypnotic suggestions that happens in A Brave New World. And I ended up titling the piece Sapiens, and it includes elements that reference like early humans. It includes a satellite beep as if it's, you know, the satellite in outer space collecting information about humans from these different time periods. It's actually the same info. So that's very personal because I thought, wow, I have really strong feelings about this book, Brave New World, and this text, and and how am I going to say that? But I think the choir will relate to it really well.
That's really neat. When you say satellite sounds, do you mean that's a sound the choir is making, or is there an electronic component?
This will be an electronic component. Maybe.
Neat. So is that?
It could be something as simple as like a beeping metronome near a microphone or something like that, I think.
Okay, so you're leaving it open to how to enact it, or is that something you'll figure out later?
Yeah. I think different conductors can use different things. Also, when I wrote it, it was pre-pandemic, so there was a body percussion element where I pictured the singers actually doing some body percussion on the bodies of other singers to mimic a heartbeat. We'll have to figure out something else for that. There's some drumstick percussion involved of rubbing the sticks together at different tempi, hitting them together, kind of starting off with the idea of, building, making fire, but then getting this rhythmic ostinato going in the piece.
I love it. But when you mentioned singers touching each other, I made a horrified face that people can't see listening to this. And like, I'm a drama teacher, right? Like, I love the idea of getting people to create art physically together. But it shows how far we've all had to go.
I know. And last year I was exploring with one of my choirs. The last performance we did involved building a human statue, which was part of our performance of the piece that we were doing, and I was just so excited about this direction that we were going into and thinking like, how can I bring this into my compositional practice? And then bam, no touching.
Wow. That's a really cool for performance, but also even just for workshopping ideas to actually get into that, to use. I mean, I find I use a lot of drama techniques. We though are getting ahead of ourselves. We're sort of talking about what I want to be sort of the last part. Let's just sort of change out the format for a moment, I think, just to keep people on their toes. And I have a series of kind of more rapid fire questions for you just to kind of see where you're at.
Ready.
And in terms of your background. Okay. So some of these I sent to you and some of them I did not. And some of them I will make up literally right now and have not thought of them yet. They will come when their time is ready.
I'm going to roll up my sleeves here.
This is inspired by listening to The Debaters on CBC Radio, although I know it isn't. I didn't think of that until right now. Okay. So Laura Hawley, what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was my voice. Although I could say when my mom was pregnant with me, she was studying music. So my first instrument maybe was her voice and whatever else she was learning, French horn, all this other stuff. But I have a tape of myself singing with my mom from age 2 that I absolutely treasure. You can hear her singing, you know, Yankee Doodle went to town. Then there's like a pause and then you hear this baby voice going, doo-dah.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah,
so that's my next question too, is who was your first teacher? Was it your mom?
It was my mom, yeah.
Who after that? Like, did you start taking formal voice lessons or did you have a choir director who got you singing with more technique at some point?
It was piano, actually. I took piano lessons.
Oh, okay.
I started with the neighbor whose backyard faced our backyard and then progressed along with piano. And then I came up with the desire to learn the violin. So I also took violin lessons for a long, long time. My mom was a voice teacher and a guitar teacher. But I didn't study those instruments, but I know that she helped me practice. I have memories of being at the piano bench together, and I know I have really fond memories of sight reading together. I know this is probably like alienating to everyone, but I love sight singing.
No, that sounds like a lovely bit of family bonding.
It's so nice.
But maybe not everyone will agree.
Well, we lived in a small town, and my mom is a choral director, and so she would order in these music packages, and we would just sit down at the piano and sight read together, and it was pretty magical.
Okay. So what about composing? When did you first know you wanted to compose?
I didn't know for years. My mom knew. And I know when I was a kid, like when I was really little, I spontaneously wrote some music for a play at the library, and I can sort of picture that happening. And then I wasn't really writing anything till university. I took a composition class.
Oh, wow.
And I did, you know, the assignments. I wasn't super aware. Well, now that I look back, I realize I loved that class. But it wasn't until I was finished university and I had been on a trip to Europe with a choir. We did a tour in France and England, and I visited Flanders Fields.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The feeling that I had there and just what it was like was not at all what I was expecting. And mm-hmm. when I came home, I just felt like compelled to try to capture that in music. So I wrote a setting of the poem. And I thought that was it. Like, I just needed to get that out of my system. But my mom had been telling me for years that I was a composer. And I thought, okay. And then, you know, I sort of wrote another piece. And for a long time, I said, well, I'm not really a composer. I'm just sort of doing this. And eventually, I kind of got to the point where I thought, I guess I'm a composer.
Composers compose is something that a teacher of mine used to say. And I think the other flip side of that is if you're composing, you're a composer. But I guess identifying as a composer is a different step. So it took a while for you to take the step of identifying, like, I am a composer. Right?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Took a certain, I guess once I started having a number of things published, and I remember it was 2013 that I started to think, like, I really need to do this more intentionally. And from that point on, maybe it was the intention, things just sort of took off from there. And I saw major growth in myself as a composer and also in people performing my works kind of from that point on. Yeah.
Well, even just devoting time to getting yourself out there is I do that in fits and starts because it takes a lot of time. So obviously you learned music theory at some point. You must have been singing in choirs all this time to feel connected to that kind of repertoire.
Oh yeah I grew up in choirs. I joined the children's choir in my town when I was maybe grade four-ish, which was amazing. And then my mom was eventually the conductor of that choir.
Oh, wow.
We moved to Ottawa, and then I joined the youth choir there and chamber. I don't think I've ever not been involved in a choir throughout my whole life. And then by late high school, I was accompanying loads of choirs. I started accompanying when I was 14 years old.
That's a great way to learn repertoire.
It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think at one point I was working for maybe five or six different choirs, which started to feel a little bit difficult to sustain.
But, did you have one of those briefcases that accompanists have with sheets flying out of it everywhere?
Oh, yeah, like the huge piles of music all over the
rushing
place.
Rushing into rehearsal from your previous rehearsal across town.
Yeah, I remember the moment actually that I realized I couldn't keep it up like this anymore. It was during the Christmas season, and I know exactly where I was. I was on stage taking a bow, and I recognized that the thoughts in my head at that moment were, do I have enough black clothing for tomorrow's concert? my apartment at the time just had like concert blacks all over the place in various states of wear, and this is probably, if I'm not able to just appreciate the end of this performance, I probably need to dial it back a bit.
Oh, should I mention here that I'm the kind of guy who doesn't watch his tux until a couple concerts have gone by?
I think that's totally legit.
They're pretty expensive to dry clean. Although I never was full busy with that, but I certainly know how busy the Christmas season can get. It certainly is the crazy time of year, especially if you're conducting as well.
Yeah. Although, as Joni Mitchell said, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, right? This year was pretty weird to not be, you know, skipping around to different performances and just sharing that music with everybody, with colleagues and audiences. And yeah, it's just a very quiet, weird
especially
time.
Because yeah, I mean, choir music is so much about togetherness. I mean, that's why there are so many choirs and so many people in choirs.
And I don't think I realized until this year how important it is to me in my artistic practice that I'm sharing the music that I'm making. The first public music making I did after months of quarantine was playing at a church service. And I really felt like, oh my gosh, wow, this feels so good to just make music for someone else and feel that that connection that you feel when you're generating something artistic and you know that people are receiving it and it really means something really important. I've been doing that my whole life. So I think if one good takeaway from the pandemic is to be able to have that moment of recognition to feel, wow, that was a big hole in my life to not be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. I miss events. In December, I had a carol singing night on Zoom with people. Yeah. Just like, okay, here's my Reader's Digest book. You choose pages, type it in the chat. I'll play it and sing it. You can sing at home, but you have to mute yourselves because otherwise it's going to sound really weird. You know, like it was a weird substitute.
Yeah.
And something like being in a room actually singing with people. I mean, I miss it horribly. I don't even have too much hope for, especially in Canada, for outdoor choir seasons, right? That you can do a couple concerts here or there. But
yeah, I mean, there's a short season for that here. I think probably we'll be doing some things in the summer. But even if the first step is just to get performers together, like the thing with making music together live is it's about the art, but that art is really a manifestation of something so much deeper. Like people in religious practices or in meditation or anything like that have understood for hundreds, probably thousands of years, the power of collective intention. And when we are collectively intending something together in a performing situation, particularly when you're singing, which involves like also like physical things changing, like heartbeats syncing up and all that kind of stuff, breathing at the same time. Like, I can't think of many things that are as powerful as that. In fact, I can't really think of anything as powerful as choral singing. That combination of the physical syncing up of people with that collective intention, that peace that's so strong, that and you're making vibration, like all of those things affect change. It's just, it's really important for our existence.
And when we look at choirs trying to find ways to rehearse and perform online, I mean, there are technical ways to reduce the time lag, but I mean, you could reduce it to nothing, to the speed of light, and you wouldn't have that sense of vibrating air together.
Yeah, it can't be replaced. The in-person thing can't. I want to be more positive and say, oh, you know, we'll get there, but we will not get there. You have to be together to get the full thing.
And when that time comes back, it's going to be incredible. I might join a choir again. You know, I haven't been a regular chorister in a while, but I think maybe I should walk the walk. I don't know what the expression is. Walk the walk, and actually like be in the room singing again, because I've realized how much I miss it. You know, when it was something I thought I could do anytime I felt like it.
Yeah.
I took it for granted, I think.
Yeah, everybody should join a choir. Honestly, it's so so deeply healthy. Like it sounds cliche to say, oh, it's good for your mental and health, spiritual health and emotional health, but it's like healthy in a really deep way, both for the individual and for the community.
Writing for choir, I think no matter who you are, when you write for choir, you write with a choir, because there's so much more time and space for composers to come in and work with the choir who's doing their music than, say, when I got to write for an orchestra and there we got 10 minutes of rehearsal, right? Like and that is not an exaggeration. It's very different when there's like a choir rehearsing for a couple of months and you can pop in, or you can even conduct them in your own music. So do you go even a step further than that in your composing? Do you write with the choir? Have you written pieces that have them contribute to the composition?
Yes, especially recently. Actually, years ago, I wrote a piece for a music camp that I taught at for years in Deep River, Ontario. And this was an extreme version of that because I asked all of the campers to bring in something that they thought represented their town, maybe something from nature. And I invited them to write poetry. So a whole bunch of them wrote poetry. I decided that I would make one kind of giant poem that combined excerpts from everybody. And then I decided that everyone in the camp should have an opportunity in this piece to play their instrument, even though, you know, the larger percentage of the campers were working on an instrument they'd never played before. So that was an interesting compositional task, because if you're playing the clarinet for the first time, the notes that you learn are not the same as if you're learning the violin for the first time. So I had to figure out where's the overlap.
Yeah. Very true.
Where's the overlap? And, you know, construct a piece that would allow them all to kind of play something, and then they would just hold their instruments and they would sing the song that also went while the senior orchestra played the accompaniment. So that was a huge undertaking that incorporated like all kinds of things from the campers. Tons of work, but so worth it, because you could see them beaming, you know, when their line of poetry came up. Or my favorite thing about this was probably the least successful compositional element. I could not figure out how to fit the alto sax into the part where all of the beginning campers played. So they got to do a drone that would fit with this interlude that the senior orchestra was doing. They were so proud of themselves that they got to play in that special moment, that they played it loud. So, you know, the senior orchestra, I heard them rehearse. They were doing a lovely job. In the performance, you saw them and you heard alto sax.
That is a very sax student thing to do, yeah, in my experience as well.
But recently, I've had a couple of projects, because choirs are all operating virtually for the most part right now. I've had a couple commissioning projects that have involved several workshops with the members of the choir leading up to the writing of the piece. And the way I've structured that, I know a few composers who have had some work like this year, and I'm really curious to at one point get everybody in the same Zoom room together and say, like, how did you do it? You know, what came out of it? Because I'm sure my approach was different. The way I did it was I kind of designed some activities for the choristers to try to think like a composer. So I would give them a text, for example, and say, and ask them a whole bunch of questions to explore in breakout rooms. And it was really fun, because these different groups would come back with totally different ways of approaching the same text, of reacting to it, of responding to it, relating to it. And then we would start to think about, you know, what does that sound like? And then once we decided what our piece was going to be about, we would again ask, what's this going to sound like? Where are the emotional high points? How do we express that in music? What's the structure? What's the backstory of this text? Is there something underneath here that we want to also have in mind with this? And then I would get, in both instances, I had this page that had the text on it with just like pencil all over it of ideas from the choristers. And it's like I said before, you know, they're amateur singers, the singers that I've been working with, but they have really strong ideas of what they want. And I think the choral community also is really hungry for new music. Like they're used to having new pieces to sing all the time. So they were so engaged in the process. And I thought to myself, like, oh, this is going to be so hard to try to incorporate this all into a piece. But in the end, it wasn't that different from if I had been writing it on my own. You know, like the usual process would be, I just get a text and off I go. But we had enough, it was sort of a melting pot of ideas, and a lot of it very high level. So, you know, I had some material to work with and then just like massage it from there. And I still went back to, like I've got this little book of compositional ideas where sometimes I sit down just on my own, and the goal is like, just come up with as many ideas as possible. Don't judge them. Don't overthink it. Maybe develop some of them later. You know, I wasn't locked out of that part of my process. I still had moments where I went back and kind of rifled through my little library and I thought, ah, here's the idea that captures what that person or what this group thought this phrase is going to be about.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was really cool. And then being able to present those pieces to the singers, and hear some feedback from them about how that changes the experience for them and their own relationship with the work and their investment in singing it. It's been cool.
It's amazing how forward young people especially can be with creating material for pieces, and how like they're such creative thinkers. The mystery for me is how to involve them right to the end of the process. Like, have you had students help figure out the form for the piece or the structure, or like, or is that sort of as you're getting ready for performance, that's a thing that sort of naturally happens? Or do you have to, as a composer, kind of go away, make a score from what they've come up with, and then come back to them?
I think probably more the latter for me. I know other composers who have had some work with students that's a lot more hands-on, where they're getting the structure and more specific musical material. I feel like I'm still developing those skills. I feel like I'm kind of a slow thinker when it comes to getting into that stuff. So I haven't figured out yet how to set that up, where it would be like a creative flow for everybody.
Yeah.
So we talked more high level, like in the projects that I've done of like, you know, I think I've had a couple things where I said, do you like this chord here or this chord here? Like, what kind of harmony do you think is happening here? Is this a moment of tension, of release? But when it comes to like the specifics, I haven't really gone there yet. This week I presented a new piece to the Calgary Philharmonic Choir that I wrote with them. This was one that had multiple workshops leading up to it. It is kind of awesome to have the opportunity to take a guided tour through the piece and tell them some of the different things that I've been thinking about. I got an email from one of the singers after saying, hey, thank you for thinking about our recovery. Because toward the end of the piece, I was explaining to them, you know, there's a moment where it builds up and it becomes kind of a big sing for a little while, and it culminates on these big chords. They're really loud. And then I said, okay, now over here, you see this humming here, and it's like mezzo piano, and the strings, meanwhile, are still like full volume. So this is just for your vocal recovery. So don't worry about trying to project. Like, it's not about balance here. It's going to be a little texture in the background while you get ready to sing this phrase over here, which is quiet and in a different register. So, you know, it was funny to have. It was great. Like, someone said, thank you for thinking of us. I feel so cared for.
Well, if musicians of any kind realize that you think of them as a human being, they really rise to that, I find. Yeah, but especially, yeah, you know, so many composers just don't, aren't as experienced with like how far you can push the human voice.
Yeah, I think that's where it helps to be an educator and a conductor. Because I kind of know, well, and having sung in choirs my whole life, I can kind of think like, what's going to feel good for me and what's going to be successful for my singers and like enable their instrument to function really well, or less well, you know, like what's going to really mess things up for them. Yeah, I'm glad that I have that kind of to lean into.
For sure. What do you think we can do as educators and as composers to get more young people doing their own composing? I think this is one way that you're talking about, which is giving them a structure to come up with ideas within, but it's your piece in the end. What do you think we can do to make them want to then, after that, go on and write their own music from scratch?
Well, I think this kind of stuff that's happening now, where the singers are getting really involved in the process, is really cool, because they can see like, oh, wow, look at all these different things that I could be thinking about. But I think the two things would be like, give them the tools. But I don't just mean like theory and musicianship, like ear training, sight singing. Like, those are really important. If you want to be able to write something down, you've got to be able to hear something in your head and then get it down on paper, if we're talking about that kind of composing. But I think it's really what I'm trying to do, and what I think we need to do, is engage their curiosity. if they're curious about something, they will pursue it. And if they feel like they have license to try stuff out, I think having free space to be able to play is so important. Even just saying, you know, write a bunch of stuff that no one else is ever going to look at. Just do it. And, you know, maybe when you're done with that, you toss it. Like, you don't have to keep it or do anything with it. But just having an emphasis on being able to explore is super important. And to not push people into any particular direction. So skills that, you know, involve improvisation, super important. Things that involve not writing music down. All and that kind of stuff, working with graphic scores. Like, I love doing that. Like, someone at any age who's never even looked at music on a staff, give them a graphic score by Murray Schafer, and they'll probably know what to do. Ask them to represent sound visually, they'll know what to do. So having that, just that creative free play time is really important.
And the way that when you work with those strategies, you get sounds out of them that are not quote unquote musical sounds and are of course very musical, but it's not. Sometimes kids are under the mistaken impression that music is the same thing as notes and rhythms, but of course music can be much broader than that. I find what you were talking about, getting them to come up with their own bits of text as well, that's a wonderful starting point, because that's something they've done before.
Yeah.
But then you can get them to think about the actual the music of that that comes from that text as well.
Yeah, what, I like that step of it. Like, okay, we've got an idea, we've got an image, we've got a text. What does it sound like?
Yeah. Yeah, people need sometimes a practical way in, or like an extra musical way in to what they're doing. Now, let's say you could somehow get into the brain of every music student in the world and teach them all, maybe, you know, or you have a Zoom call with millions of kids. What's one skill or concept or philosophy that you think that all music students should learn?
This is such an easy one for me. It would be listening. 100%. The ability to just get really excited about something that you're hearing for as much time as possible, not just musical, but just like, maybe you're out for a walk. How many things can you hear? What do those sounds feel like? I think the world that we live in doesn't really invite much listening as a singular task. We are usually listening while we're doing something else, like driving or going for a walk or doing dishes or whatever.
Guilty, guilty.
Totally. Me too. And when I do just sit and listen, I'm like, oh man, this is a great activity. So to encourage people to listen and to somehow empower learning music, well, learning any musician of any age or level, encouraging them to listen deeply and be really in the moment. I had some lessons with a composition teacher, Alan Bell. He teaches at the University of Calgary.
Sure.
And he said, well, actually, every lesson I had was so fantastic for me. I felt silly in those lessons because I would sometimes be fighting back tears because I was just so like inspired by what I was learning from him and his approach. And someone else told me that he said, being a composer, you have to have the three C's. It's curiosity, creativity, and compassion, which I think is actually kind of true about life as well. So I think those three things are kind of the guiding stars of what we would do. And if we can kind of activate all that and some listening, get kids curious about what they hear, and then just, you know, like I said, let them, I don't know why I'm always saying kids because it's really any age, but let people play, let the people explore, at whatever level. A friend of mine teaches a composition at a university in the States, and he recently was talking about, you know, these applications that come in from kids who feel like they have to submit something in their portfolio for like symphony orchestra for an undergrad. And he said, you know, don't encourage your, like, teachers out there, let your kids work on the things that makes sense scale-wise, so they can actually explore their ideas without being stuck in this like requirement of writing something huge. Like they don't have the craft yet. Let them write something for one instrument or two instruments and mm-hmm. really show their ideas.
And so, work with real players too, yeah, as opposed yeah. to with a notation software, a symphony orchestra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you say are the differences between working with kids, students, and working with adult amateurs?
I would say actually there are differences, but not like loads. Like it's not like there's a dividing line between two. I think, you know, when you're working with developing musicians at any age, there are certain things that you're always going to be taking into consideration. And that's where the differences land. Like for kids, what's healthy, I'm again going to choral music, but what's healthy for their voice, what's going to empower them to learn to sing well, what kinds of things can they listen for and hear in the music and relate to. But again, this is not really different from working with older singers. I think one thing that's a priority for me with younger musicians is to make sure that they have a text that's got integrity. I really steer away from texts that are sort of like about like a magical rainbow above a castle in the sky type stuff. Like something that engages them and their concerns or their interests, or maybe it even has some words that they don't know yet, but they're going to learn those words and understand them. I think having some musical material and some text material that respects them as artists is really important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's end with going back to that idea of listening. Because actually it's funny how you've sort of segued into some things related to the secret questions I wrote that I was going to surprise you with. But I'm always curious about, like, for you, where's that line between music and noise?
I don't know. I think the more, like the further I get into my artistic practice, the fewer there are things that are not music. Like, for example, I can be lying in the snow in the forest at twilight, kind of feeling the little snowflakes landing on me, and it feels musical. Like, I know mm-hmm. there's music in there, and... Mm-hmm. I often write when I'm out for ski or something like that. But I guess I'm talking about nature because I think I do a lot of, I get a lot from spending time in nature. But even if I'm looking around the room, you know, like the pattern on the curtains on the window could be musical.
Okay, so there can be visual musical patterns as well.
Yeah,
you're looking for textures and patterns in the world. What would you say is your favorite non-musical or non-typically musical sound? Is it like a particular natural sound that
it would have to be the sound of the water. I grew up in Lake Huron, so mm-hmm. when I get back to the beach there and hear the water moving, it's probably my favorite sound. A close second would likely be the sound of the wind in poplar trees.
Yes, that is a special sound. What music do you listen to when you need to, like, shut the world out? Like, when you're feeling overwhelmed, or you want to focus on something, or you want to indulge your negative thought patterns, or whatever you want to do when you're alone, what music do you spend that time with?
I like a lot of different styles. I listen to lots of choral music, of course. And there are probably some go-to recordings for bliss-out purposes that I would go to. But I also like, I wrote my master's thesis about Ella Fitzgerald, and I listen to tons of jazz. I love jazz, instrumental jazz, vocal jazz, all kinds of stuff. I listen to a lot of folk singers, like Annie DeFranco is one of my favorites. I feel like she's been a constant in my life for so long. And, you know, you kind of get close to an artist, right? And you see their evolution and see their life unfold throughout their albums. I listen to a lot of Bjork. I love the textures in there. That's definitely a kind of lie down and bliss out kind of experience.
talking about like the rhythms of nature, I feel like there's something like elemental, natural in her textures.
Well, and actually she has taken lots of samples from nature, like from volcanoes or snow crunching, or even she's got a piece where some of the samples are from static sounds taken from running your hand through someone else's hair. There's all kinds of amazing, she's an incredible artist. She's got a piece that generates music from artificial intelligence that captures the patterns in the sky above this this hotel. So it could be airplanes, could be birds, could be clouds. So her stuff is amazing. One of my favorite albums of all time is Graceland by Paul Simon. I could listen to that beautiful. Like, every day. I don't really have one particular style. I do like to listen, like I have to be careful where I do it, because if I'm really listening to something that I'm really into while I'm driving, I'll just, the thing I do all the time is I use a red light as a stop sign. So I have to be really careful where I'm listening.
Oh dear.
It's not good. Yeah.
I've had those. It's been a while, but I've had those like you're driving home at night and something comes on the radio and you have to pull over and listen to it for half an hour before you go inside.
Yeah, I do the pullover as well. Yeah. I've learned just stop and listen.
Yeah. George Crumb piece did that to me once.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Those things that just are transcendent. You're talking about Bjork. Are you familiar with Tanya Tagaq?
Yeah, I've seen her live a number of times, actually.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that's like the power of what she does. Is the first time I saw her, I remember just feeling completely gutted, like I was weeping.
Well, she in the live performances, she finds that whole natural, elemental, and human sound world all in one with just her own voice. I find that just astounding. Yeah, and then on the albums, she layers it and does so much more.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing stuff. Cool. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I'm going to have to edit this down a bit.
Yeah.
And is there anything else you wanted to say or to end off with? Like, do you have a parting thought about music education or working with choirs or?
Parting thought about music education it's probably the obvious thing, but how important it is. Like for many of the reasons, like we've talked about, just how important it is in terms of deep, deep health, community and individual health to be making music together, to stimulate that creativity. And music, I think, is quite possibly our greatest achievement of human evolution. And to not be engaging with that is like not engaging with the highest thing in our human evolution. So we have to prioritize that. Like that's it just, I don't even have words to express how mind-boggling it is to me that is not a focus of education. I think every single child and person of any age or ability level should have access to music and to artistic expression and to be able to do that every day and develop that side of themselves and nurture it.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's my big pitch for music education.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've somehow all as a society come under the impression that music is something that, well, used to be on a CD or now something that you stream, or that music is on a piece of sheet music, right? That it's like a thing.
Yeah.
But it's really an experience. It's a process. It's an outlet. So that participatory element is what's been lost.
And I think we often hold music and any arts education up to things like science and math and reading, and like they're two different things, which also I feel like we've got to get rid of that. Like they're not different things at all. All of those things are in music.
And you can teach music in a way that's very interested in the science of it. I'm thinking much more now about like how our voices work and how two notes play together and the ratio of the sound and how the acoustics of the room, and like those are things that young people can understand if you put it in their terms and
do it in my rehearsals with my choirs. Like we're talking about overtones and how they exist and how it impacts our tuning. We're looking at these graphs that show that kind of stuff. Like I don't know, we've just got to do music.
Yeah. I've also been increasingly realizing that even listening to a recording is participatory, because it's not just that music isn't music till it gets to your brain, which is true. Like, it's your brain that puts the sounds together into music. There isn't even sound until it gets into your ear and your brain. It's just vibrations. And it's your ear which is made to listen to sounds of a certain type, and your brain which is made to sort them out. And just, I've been dumbfounded thinking about how we decode these vibrations into sound and then music. And like, we need to share this with all the young people we know. Like this is really exciting. Maybe that should be day one of your music class, perhaps, is like, what the heck is going on?
Yeah, let's listen. Let's do some listening. And it seems like now we have to justify everything with a study and compare it to it. Even in our conversation, it's hard to steer away from not trying to justify music education because it contains science and all this other
Of
stuff.
course, I know.
Like we know intuitively that this is like deeply beneficial and touches on a whole web of things, and we have evolved to be musical. So, but even that, just the fact that music can be beautiful and allow us to express something should be like top value. What is more important than that?
Well, this has been a great conversation. I must say, I like this podcasting thing. I'm looking
Yeah, this
forward
is
to.
fun. And it's fun. Like, I'm also meeting you for the first time today, and I'm like, I can't wait till we hang out next time. Like, there's
Well,
so much to talk about.
if Podium ever happens, then
Yeah.
maybe next summer, then, or no, the summer after, probably at this rate,
Yeah, in
then.
the most recent newsletter, I saw there's an announcement in March about Podium 2022.
All right, I'm just popping in again here to tell you what Podium is. Podium is a conference that is put on by Choral Canada that happens every 2 years somewhere in our country. The last one was supposed to be in May of 2020 in Montreal, and obviously it got postponed. So that's what Laura and I are talking about.
Rehearsal
I know, in
because,
a way, it's like, let's all just go to sleep for a year and then wake up and just do
yeah,
it when it's real
I'm
again.
in favor of that. Every winter I say this, the winter comes, we've already organized, Thanksgiving and like massive eating festivals. And I'm sure the next step, like, eat all of that food
A
and
sleeping
then
festival.
go to sleep, have a
Yep, let's
giant
hibernate.
hibernation.
The amount of chocolate chips and Harvest Crunch cereal that I eat by the handful every winter, but like especially this one,
Like together,
right?
like a deconstructed
No,
cookie.
just
Okay.
a different whenever whichever box I see is the one that I go for. But yeah, I'm definitely meant to be hibernating.
Yeah, me too. I recently have a mayonnaise problem. Like my go-to lunch is a tin of sardines because I work and then I'm like, oh, I should probably eat at some point today, but I don't really have time to think about it. Just crack open the tin, put a scoop of mayo on, done.
That is very, is that British, or is that sounds like a very Belgian thing to do. I don't know.
I don't know
It's
how it how
somewhere across the pond.
yeah anything that's a
That
vehicle for mayo is cool with me.
that seems like an appropriate and delicious place to stop our interview. So I talked to Laura afterward. There's a few things she said she wished she'd mentioned. So I'm going to work them in as a plug here. The big one would be a new project called Sonic Time Lapse. And it's funny, we'll actually be talking about this in a couple of episodes with Katarina Gimmon, who's one of Laura's collaborators. So the Sonic Time Lapse project is at sonictimelapse, all one word, .com. And it's a collaborative choral art commissioning project created as a response to the global COVID-19 pandemic, with the goal of gathering content from the emotional landscape of choral communities in Canada and beyond. Using an innovative crowdfunding model, this project brings together shared creativity and financial resources in a time of need to fund the creation of 10 new works, as well as support online programming for participating choirs. So that's something you should definitely check out. Laura also wanted me to mention a few of her pieces she's written specifically that have to do with educational engagement. There was one for Cantiamo choirs, and these are pieces that are designed to incorporate learning for both groups of people, for choirs and for conductors. So there's a piece called The Sun Is Mine, and then the next year she wrote Earth Voices, and another piece called Maple Key for Coastal Sound in BC. It's part of the same sort of set. So I'll post links to these pieces. So if you'd like to learn more about Laura Hawley, you could go to her website. That's laurahawley.ca, LauraHawley.ca. And she has links to videos and information about all her music there and where to get the scores. There's a great section called the LAH Energy Exchange, which involves mutually beneficial exchanges between colleagues and ensembles in the spirit of mutual support and community building. These collaborations are developed on a case-by-case basis by contacting Laura Hawley. So these could be like exchanging a choral reading session featuring her music in exchange for a workshop with Laura, or producing a recording of a piece by Laura in exchange for a free download from her self-published scores. So I think these are great ideas. I'm totally going to steal them. And Laura has really set up a great career for herself. So that's it for the first episode of the Fresh Sounds podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks to listen to my interview with Dean Burry, a composer of opera aimed at children. And 2 weeks after that, about a month from now, we'll be sitting down with Katarina Gimmon to talk again about writing for choirs. So if you have not subscribed yet, please do so in your favorite podcast aggregator. You can find us on Facebook. We have a page called Fresh Sounds Podcast. You can find me, Alex Eddington, at my website, alexeddington.com. That's alexeddington.com. I'm also on Twitter and various other places as alexeddington_1. This podcast was made possible by the Alliance for Canadian New Music Projects, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about them. So the ACNMP is an organization dedicated to the promotion of Canadian contemporary music. Throughout their history, it's been their mission to encourage teachers to teach Canadian contemporary music, to motivate students to study and perform this music, and to encourage Canadian composers to write music for students of all levels, from the most junior to the paraprofessional. Their mission is to commission, promote, and preserve Canadian contemporary music as a cornerstone of our national heritage by fostering its performance among students, teachers, and performers through education, festivals, and workshops. And there are various ways they do this: through student workshops, children's choral workshops, ensemble workshops, and composing in the classroom activities. Every year in their Contemporary Showcase Festival, there is a student composition class that promotes and encourages young composers of today. They do outreach in the form of teacher information sessions. The ACNMP has an online syllabus you should check out. It's graded music encompassing 25 instruments, vocal and choral categories, including solos and ensembles, and it's an important resource for students of Canadian music, and it's updated pretty frequently. The ACNMP has also commissioned more than 50 new works for music education and study since its inception, many from Canada's leading composers. So I've been involved in terms of having music in the syllabus. I'm currently sitting on the ACNMP board, and that was, as I mentioned earlier, the genesis of this podcast. But go check out everything about them. So they are at acnmp.ca. And if you are a Canadian composer, please consider submitting some works for the syllabus and getting involved in other ways. Just a couple of credits. I'd like to thank Steph Chua for creating the art and the logo for this podcast. And a big thanks also to Sam Shahi, who created incredible music, including that one at the beginning using my voice. We're going to go out with a piece by Laura Hawley. Here's Laura's piece called Absence, performed here by Pro Choro Canada and directed by Michael Tsaug.
Scarcely left you. for me, O sweetness.